Good morning on a gorgeous spring day in Park City. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells, and neither of us are good at humming our theme song, so we thought about it.
We spared everybody in the audience.
So we're leaping on the radio without the theme song this morning. Heading for a high of 65 today. Go out and catch some spring corn in the next few hours, and settle back and listen to Mountain Money if you could. Our first guest is Beth Levine, and Beth Levine is the author of a new book called Jock Talk, Five Communications Principles for Leaders, as exemplified by legends of the sports world. So this will be a little bit about communication and some good sports stories, and we'll have some fun with Beth as we talk about communicating and learning from the pros. Not just in communicating, but the pros in sports.
And if you love sports and you love business, that's going to be a fun conversation. And we're going to stay with the business theme with David Colling. He's the CEO of Hendrickson Butler. And we're going to talk about how the workplace has evolved. They do a lot of the high-end Larry business furniture. And he's going to talk to us about how furniture helps set the culture and how furniture can help you as your business evolves. And then our last guest, it's actually a big theme. I've mentioned it earlier on one of our shows, Artisan Chocolate. And I was in San Francisco, and my family had a great time visiting this teeny tiny chocolate shop that some guy that sold some .com multimillionaire started Artisan Chocolate. Well, we have our own version of that right here in Park City. It's called Ritual Chocolate. And it was started up by Anna Davis and Robbie Stout, and we're going to have both of them on as guests. So we got a little bit of sports, a little bit of business, and a little bit of chocolate. We have some for everybody this morning.
Indeed.
Stay tuned. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. We'll be back in a moment.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back, and the subject to start Mountain Money this morning is a jock talk. We're going to talk sports. We're going to talk communications with Beth Levine. Beth is a local author. She's from Salt Lake, but she's a national consultant for in the communications business. She helps Fortune 500 executives, professional and world-class athletes, and other high-profile individuals effectively think about, prepare for, and deliver their messages to important audiences. And Beth, welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
I guess the first question would be, what can we learn from jocks? Because when you hear pithy sound bites from them in the locker room, I don't know that I hear any great wisdom coming out.
That's so interesting. You know, there's a stereotype out there that jocks aren't that smart. But when you sit and work with them, as I have, you learn that people like them who are making these split-second judgment calls out on the field of play, they're super smart, they're very coachable, and when you think about it, they're responsible for the reputation or image of a brand and the franchise. So they're incredible to work with, and because their communications are so high stakes, you know, they can make or break a career with a soundbite. I think they make great teachers, as many have, yeah. And now they're making or breaking careers with people's pictures on their cell phones. So they've got what's coming out of their mouths and what people are capturing on.
Just ask Brett Favre about that one.
It's hard to live your life. You know, I think any of us, if we had a microphone on us 24/7, would have plenty of sound bites that were silly. Right. So it's, you know, I think it is a stereotype about athletes. And as I think about raising my two teenage daughters and the things that are teaching them life skills that are important to me, the Park City school system is doing a great job academically. But the sports are some of the more powerful skills. As somebody that's now 50 looking back on life, I know how important it is for them to be a leader and to be a good member of a team. And my heart just gets warm when I see them playing sports because I know they're learning that. Talk to us about some of the key business skills that you think that have come out of some of the athletes. You start off your book, or actually it's chapter 2, with a Wimbledon example. It's a very famous speech. Andy Murray, a very gracious speech after his loss. Actually, he wasn't on the top of his game then. It was us seeing how graciously he could accept defeat in his speech after losing to Roger Federer. Tell us that story.
So that's in the chapter on audience centricity, and everything I do in my coaching practice really begins with being audience-centric versus ego-centric. So by that, I mean literally planning and executing your talk based on your audience, not on yourself, what interests you, or your most compelling, what you think is most compelling about your topic, but really focusing on the audience. And the Andy Murray story is great because in that, it was a horrendous moment of defeat at Wimbledon, so in his home country with his home crowd of fans. Rather than being in himself and, you know, anything sort of self-servingly sulky or anything else, he tipped his hat to the fans and told them what a huge difference it makes. That it's, I forget the exact quote right now, but it's almost as if he's saying, you know what? Losing is bad and I'm sad about it, but you guys make all the difference in the world. And he took that moment to address his fans, and he was choked up at the time too.
And I think the power of that is, had he won that tournament, it would not be as powerful. The fact that he did that in his moment of defeat is what I think we all admire.
Right, exactly. And you mentioned graciousness. I mean, there are, and we talked about this before we went on air, but in the chapter on graciousness, the story of what not to do is exemplified by Dan Gilbert, the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, when LeBron first left for Miami. And that's a sort of a notorious, he went on an absolute rant. I think he took out a full-page ad in the local paper, and he kept the rant up on the team website until about 2 weeks before LeBron came back. So it was up there for 4 years.
And I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. We talked about this. We called the room we were chatting about the green room ahead of time. And my father and my brother, my whole family still lives there. My father never forgave, and my father passed away just before LeBron James came back. My father never forgave Dan Gilbert for doing that. And look at the graciousness. Essentially, Dan Gilbert lost 6 years ago, whenever LeBron left 4 years ago, lost. And instead of being gracious about it and leaving the door open, and kudos to LeBron James for coming back after being treated like
that. Right. It's actually remarkable. And when he came back, both of them said very little. They just, it was, I think, all business.
And for people that don't know LeBron James, the reason he came back, he grew up just south of Cleveland, Ohio, in Akron, in a very poor place. And he's done a lot of, even when he was playing for Miami, he continued to do a lot of good in the Cleveland area. And it just shows where his heart is. His heart was he wanted to give back to that community.
Right. Well, Dan Gilbert had the opportunity to do what the good example in the graciousness chapter did. And the good example is Lou Gehrig. So that's probably the oldest sports story in the book. But Lou Gehrig, knowing that he was, you know, having his last game, stood up at the microphone in Yankee Stadium and, you know, said he was the luckiest guy on earth, even though he knew he was dying.
And going to have a horrible death.
I mean, and going to have a really, death. It is, it is. With ALS. And what I say in that chapter is, you know, you really have the opportunity to set the tone and the emotions of your audience when you have bad news. And so Dan Gilbert had bad news. He could have rallied the community, rallied the team, and said, you know, this is a loss. Acknowledge it's a loss, and then moved forward. So it combines a little bit of the, you know, he certainly was very transparent. He showed his anger and his upset, but he wasn't very gracious.
And that's one example, going back to the tennis world and Wimbledon. Of course, there are a lot of bad boys, maybe more in tennis, but they're certainly more famous. Jimmy Connors, Rance, John McEnroe,
McEnroe,
nasty. What was his name?
The line call.
What is the consequence for those who can't control their emotions and go into the post game press conference angry.
So, you know, it's funny about sports. I always say and business is much more complex than sports in this way. But in sports, there are only two potential outcomes, right? You win or you lose. So when I work with an athlete, it makes it kind of simple. We can sit down and say, you know, what kind of a winner do you want to be? Right? And what kind of a loser do you want to be? Let's develop those mindsets and those messages now so that you're not at all ambushed when the microphone comes into your face.
And I know you've talked to Utah Jazz. You've got some logos up on your website. Uh-huh. Utah Jazz is a client of yours. Are you speaking with the players and giving them this message or with management?
In the past, I've addressed the team as a whole and worked one-on-one with clients and also with management front office. So it's interesting. Yeah. And the players are, I have to say, they're young, they're boys, really, and they're large. And, you
yes,
know,
they
this,
are.
This is the expectation we have for athletes is partly because of what they do, how high profile they are, how much we know they get paid. We have these expectations, and they're kids. And so I have a lot of compassion and a lot of empathy for the position they find themselves in.
So let's talk about the theme of kids, because it's an important thing to me. I'm raising two teenage kids, and there's a lot of wisdom that comes from making a bunch of mistakes over a 50-year journey, as I have. What are some things that you have found that are effective to help these younger people, either in sports or in business, kind of understand the importance of the themes that are in your book?
So one thing I do with athletes, and I did this with a group of free skiers who were going to Sochi in the fall of 2013, was to show them what their peers look like on television. For some reason, that's very captivating.
So showing them the mistakes.
Showing them the range, okay. Let's say, yeah. From the spectrum of good to bad. They really get it. I mean, again, I'll always stand behind athletes and say they are smart as whips. They really are. And they get it if they see it. The other thing I do, I have this, and it's in the book. It's in the first chapter. So I have this exercise. Now I'm telling it on radio, so no one will ever be surprised again. But for instance, with a Jazz player, we sit down, I have a camera set up, and we roll the cameras to role play an interview. And I hand the player a toothbrush. And they're sitting there like, why is she giving me a toothbrush? What is this all about? And it's really, when you think about it, and I ask a bunch of questions, I interview him about the toothbrush. When you think about it, there is nothing more self-explanatory and mundane and obvious than a toothbrush. And that's what it feels like to an athlete to get asked after you win, how does it feel? After you lose, how does it feel? It's like you...
But yet the audience, that's what we all want to know.
But the audience wants a robust answer. Yeah. And so the practice is give me robust answers to questions I'm asking you about the toothbrush.
So, you know, you chatted with some athletes going over to Sochi, fall of 2013.
Uh-huh.
You mentioned in the green room that you, one of your clients is USSA here in town.
Right. Done a lot of work
Larry,
with
them. You probably saw after Sage won the gold medal on his snowboard. I just loved his enthusiasm and excitement and humbleness that came from that moment. How important do you think it was for an athlete like Sage to think about, you know, hey, if I'm fortunate enough to win the gold, what would be two or three things that I would want to say just so he's got that in his back pocket thankfully he won, if that it comes to be?
That's really important. In fact, the last of the five principles in the book, in Jock Talk, is preparedness. And the example I use, what not to do example I use, is Danica Patrick, the race car driver. When she won her first big race in Japan, she rambles. They asked, the ESPN reporter was like feeding her the easiest questions in the world about how does it feel? What is this moment like? You know, big, like, come on,
you a softball.
Yeah, I'm giving you three softballs in a row. You had to know this moment was coming. And she just completely fumbles, has nothing prepared. So here, I mean, you know, some of the skiers and snowboarders that come out of Park City and come out of the USSA, a lot of them, they go in there thinking it could be me today, and a lot of them don't.
And, you know, part of the great thing about Sage's story is I suspect, I he lives down the street, I've never asked him, but I suspect he was thinking it was a long shot for him to win a gold
right.
medal.
It was a long shot for him to get in the games.
Right. But with Danica Patrick, she just completely fumbled it. She had to know all eyes are on her, waiting for her to win, and she had nothing to offer up. Nothing. You should read that chapter.
And one thing you stress also is brevity, but there's a fine line, and especially with jocks, with athletes, I mean, short answers are often what you get.
Right.
not
like Jerry Sloan.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in that Jazz locker room and tried to interview some of these guys, and they're three-word answers, and yet you stress brevity. So clearly there's a fine line between Danica Patrick and and an angry athlete who just lost a game and doesn't want to talk.
Right. Let's actually take the issue of brevity and segue from sports to business for a second. And I think that it's fair to say that your average business meeting, business presentation, and even a lot of speakers, keynote speakers, they're just too long. And audiences just don't have the capacity for all that information and for the brain dumps that often happen. And so being brief and paying attention to your audience is just about the most audience-centric thing you can do.
I want to ask you about the idea of being brief, because there are people that, you know what, they really should only chat for 3 minutes. And then on the other end of the equation, sorry, Larry, here comes Steve Jobs. You have somebody like Steve Jobs.
Well, we got 22 minutes in before.
You have somebody like Steve Jobs that could hold our attention for a half hour, 45 minutes, or an hour. And I consider myself, I give a lot of presentations. I consider myself a student of presentations. I like to watch great presentations. And then I like to hear thoughts of people that understand presentations and share why it is. And there's a woman I like to watch, Nancy Durante. I don't know if
you... Nancy Duarte, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. I've mispronounced her last name, sorry. But her theme is like these moments of brevity kind of weave together. And she talks about, you know, problem and then solution, which Jobs would do. You know, we all have a problem. We want the internet in our back pocket, but none of the phones were. So there's the problem. There's the solution. Then he comes back down to another problem, solution. Do you have to be a Steve Jobs in order to be able to weave together those moments of brevity? Are most of us better served just thinking in a keynote, what are the three things I want the audience to leave with? Tell a fun story at the beginning to get their attention. Tell them the 3 points and then leave. Or is that something that somebody like myself that likes to be a student of presentations, is that something that somebody that's dedicated to it can learn to do, weave those points together?
I think you can. So Steve Jobs is a great example. First of all, he was always prepared. He never had more than 3 key points, which is important. They were his own words. He did not have people prepare these things for him. And that's huge, because let's face it, I go into a lot of organizations where they give their employees message points to use. Well, they're little paragraphs that were written by somebody else. Nobody can regurgitate that. It's not realistic. So Steve Jobs is a great example, and he used stories. And that's where Nancy Duarte's philosophy comes in also. You have to build these little vignettes. And also what you're referring to and what she talks about is really creating these, you know, peaks where you can bring the audience's attention back to you. So basically what's wrong with a lot of presentations and speeches is people are paying attention at the beginning, because you pay attention then, you want to see what's coming up. Then their attention and their ability to retain dips for a large portion of the presentation. And when the audience hears you winding up to close, they pay attention again. So a typical curve It's hard to draw on radio, but
I'm seeing you do it. Yeah, I've seen Nancy's presentation.
Does she have the same curve?
She's got peaks
in the beginning, and it goes down to a valley, and it comes back up at the end. But what you want to do is create a presentation that has constant peaks and valleys, so that you have constant. You create constant opportunities to pull the audience's attention
And that's just good speaking, but it also captures shorter attention spans.
That's
people,
right.
Attention spans probably were never very long to begin with, but they are shortening now. You like you say, you pay attention at the beginning of the speech, and then you go check your email on
That's
your cell phone.
There
That's
really
right.
is an art and a science to storytelling. There is
yes.
a format. And
yep.
for those of us that spent most of their lives in the business world, I find myself looking at some of these softer issues. You know, how does a good book get written? What is that format? Because we can borrow that in presentations as well. Let me ask you, when you were writing your book, you know, one of the main themes in your book is target your message to the audience.
Right.
The challenge with a book is you have one message, or in your case, five chapters, but a very broad audience.
Mm-hmm.
How did you reconcile those issues?
So that's an interesting question, because the publisher put what's called a substantive editor on me, who went line by line and absolutely challenged every line of the original manuscript. But what we agreed on from the get-go was this book was going to be for leaders and aspiring leaders. It could really apply to anyone. But she made me write to the highest common denominator. So it's really written to the leader, somebody who's already there.
So write to the highest common,
denominator,
not lowest.
And
you hear a
right.
lot of times, right? Why do you think that is? Why? Because you limit your audience by doing that. It
well,
makes your book more powerful.
Her point was that even aspiring leaders and people who are sort of growing their careers will identify with someone who's successful and will identify with that leader and pull themselves along using the book.
Well, and I think it reads, it's an easy enough read that if you have a high school student that's into sports that you want to start teaching some of these thoughts, it's a way to kind of sneak it into their life. So graduation is coming up.
It's a last, great graduation
last year, gift. Last year we had Adam, what was Adam's last name? The Promise of a
Braun.
Pencil.
Adam Braun.
That was a book that I recommended people think about for graduation, and this would definitely be on my list for this year.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
And we appreciate you coming in. Beth Levine is the author of Jock Talk, Five Communications Principles for Leaders as Exemplified. This is a long
subtitle.
Subtitle, as exemplified by legends of the sports world. Thanks so much for joining us. The book comes out right about now. Right?
Thank you, Doug and Larry. Appreciate it.
Beth, we enjoyed having you. Thanks for coming in.
And when we come back, we're going to talk about the future and present of office design and how the workplace has evolved with Hendrickson and Butler, one of the leading design firms for offices in the Intermountain West, after this message.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We have been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976 and have been proud supporters of KPCW since its beginning. More information can be found at bhhsutah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
The gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR.
Sunday mornings at 10 on 91.9 FM KPCW. Brought to you in part by Park City Film Studios and Crandall Capital.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Boy, sports and business, and now we're switching. It's furniture, which, you know, I think a lot of folks would say, what does furniture have to do?
Oh, it's not furniture. It's design.
Design. What does that have to do with business? I think folks are going to be very surprised and interested. In studio with us now is David Collin. He's the CEO of Hendrickson Butler, and he's going to talk to us about how the workplace has evolved and kind of my lead in, you know, what is the role of furniture and design in creating the culture in the workspace that you want. So welcome to Mountain Money, and there's your lead in question, if you don't mind starting with that.
Absolutely. No problem at all. Happy to be on today. We think about the workplace. We have seen a pretty dramatic shift in the importance of space, right, to any kind of an organization. We think of offices, but we certainly do corporate office environments. We do healthcare environments. We do educational environments, government environments. So it's all types of space that really help people do better work. And there's a variety of things that have changed in the last few years that have kind of precipitated that.
You know, we just had a guest in here, Beth Levine, that talks about, you know, presentations. And one of the things we didn't get to talk about is when you give a presentation, your audience is sizing you up in the first 8 seconds, she has in her book. And I've heard that before. It's the same thing when somebody comes into your office. They are sizing up what kind of company it is, what kind of culture it is. I recently had an experience in Salt Lake City. I don't know if you've been to the holodeck. It's a shared workspace.
I'm not.
The elevator doors open and you immediately have a positive impression. You have an idea of what this place is about. Talk to us about how that happens and why that's important for a company.
We actually call that 3D branding. So really, when you walk into a space, when I walk into your space, I get an immediate impact of your brand, whether it's conservative, whether it's contemporary, whether it's progressive, whether it's modern. You know, I get a sense, frankly, whether it's nice, whether it's dumpy. You know, and that has a lot to do with attracting and retaining employees, right? There's nothing more important right now than the war for talent, right? Getting the best people and hanging on to them. And as we see a lot of organizations upgrade those spaces dramatically, I can tell you when somebody's interviewing, especially, I hate to say, the younger generation has more interest in that physical space. So it's a big deal. It's sending a message, again, to clients, to employees, to suppliers, to any constituency you deal with.
It kind of seems to me that there are traditional offices like the one my dad worked at, and everybody's in an office, and then there's the secretarial pool out more in the open, that offices really started changing when the software business started. And all of a sudden, there were ping pong tables and everybody was in one room, and it just blew up. It seemed to me the software business blew up the concept of an office workspace.
There's no question that the tech employees, again, a younger generation, many times, I hate to say, keep talking about that from an age perspective, but certainly the younger generation has a different interest and expectation of the workplace. What we're seeing today, though, is we're seeing the individual space is shrinking quite a bit, right? We're seeing less need for the individual space, more need for group and community spaces. A lot of the reason for that is, if you think about it, Herman Miller, the manufacturer we work with, has done a lot of surveys around how often people are actually in their space. You'd be amazed. A workstation is used on average less than 60% of the time, right? So 40%+ of the time that workstation is empty. Private office is considerably less yet. Well, you say, where are these people at? A couple of things. They're really connecting with their coworkers. Work has become more social. That a need to connect and collaborate and share knowledge has become more important. So they're in conference rooms, they're in lobbies, they're in entryways. With technology, they might be at Starbucks. You know, so those individual spaces are not being used as often.
Yeah, exactly. A big open space. Yeah. So yeah, speaking of space is expensive here in Park City, right? So, you know, design, part of the challenge of design is some of the nice furniture is great. It invokes the image that you want. It tends to be expensive. So if you're a startup, that's hard to do. But talk to us about how you might be able to pay a little bit more on the design, but make better use of your space and overall be ahead of the game.
Yeah, there's no question design and the proper space planning, really engaging professional that understands how to lay out spaces is really important. I walk into a lot of offices and see a lot of wasted space. In fact, I see that all the time. So it's the utilization of space is extremely important in making sure. You know, the other thing, too, is when you think about furniture, when I talk to CFOs and CEOs and others that have issues around the financial component, you know, good quality commercial furniture. We got clients that have furniture that's 20, 25, 30 years old. It lasts a long time. So
let's talk about some of that furniture that's 20, 25 years old, because about that time is when the cubicle came out.
Yeah.
And which very few people like working in cubicles. There's ways to make it more palatable for folks. But we had a guest on, Larry, that gave us the history of the cubicle, and I was kind of surprised. I forget the gentleman's name. That came up with, and you're giving me a mysterious look, so maybe you don't know the story. The guy that designed it, I think it was at Herman Miller, and ultimately said, no, we shouldn't do this, and didn't want to go there. Tell us, Remind our audience of that story. We heard it a year or two ago, but it's been a while.
Yeah, a gentleman by the name of Bob Probst, actually working for the Herman Miller Research Corporation, actually designed the cubicle. And if you look back, there's a book. You can still have it. We have it in the showroom. It's called A Facility Based on Change. And if you read Mr. Probst's original research and thinking around the workstation, he never planned for it to become this cubicle farm. His initial design for Action Office, which we actually still sell today, was one of user adjustment. It was one of open 120-degree angles. It was one of multiple work postures. He never meant to create the cubicle farm. So I think in years after, he was frankly concerned about what he'd really, really created, because those were the first workstations ever.
I've worked in a line of cubicles out of college.
Right.
And you feel like a drone coming to work.
Well,
saps the energy out of
you. You know, the ultimate book on the cubicle is Dilbert.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Dilbert's given us some great press over the years.
Yeah. And so have, in modern office design, have cubicles gone out of fashion?
Yeah, to some extent, yes. I mean, there are still millions of workstations.
Especially if you go into a government office, it's a sea of cubicles.
Right, and we're seeing that change significantly, and I'll tell you about how we're seeing that change. So again, we're seeing that individual workstation shrink in size. We're seeing those panels come down. We're seeing a lot more. There's a lot of research and study that's been done about the impact of natural light on a worker and worker productivity and worker health. So we're seeing a lot more desire to create more glass on the exterior walls, get that glass into the core. So we used to build offices around the perimeter. Well, what a waste, because you can't get the light into the interior space. So we're seeing offices move to more of the core of the space. Even those offices have a lot of glass. We're seeing the height of the workstations actually drop significantly.
So you have more of a sense of community.
Exactly. You're more connected to people. Yeah. And again, then we're seeing more what we call group and community spaces. So there's more spaces for a team to have a quick meeting that are in closed spaces, or somebody to go do have a conversation in more of a private space. But those workstations themselves are lower and open to more collaboration and connection with people.
Now, the problem becomes you need quiet spaces.
Correct.
And you need to talk to employees in confidence and clients in confidence. So what do you suggest? Retreat rooms where you can go close a door and have a private conversation?
Great question. It's really a repurposing of that entire space. So again, as those workstations shrink, those private offices shrink, we're seeing more of just what you said, spaces where people can connect and communicate in private, right? Even spaces where people can do focused, heads-down work. Some of the way we're getting some of that space is it used to be we'd build a lot of big conference rooms. When you start to look at and measure what happens in conference rooms, you see conference rooms for 8 and 10 and 14 people with two people in them. Happens all the time. Three people, four people. Rarely do you see those being used for their full use. So we're seeing more of those divided up into smaller spaces that are better for two and three and four small meetings, and then also individual work.
Which brings up a point, right? If you're Apple computers, sorry, I'm weaving it in again, Larry. You're building a brand new corporate headquarters. You know, you have a lot of flexibility, you have a lot of freedom here in the design. Most of us don't get that luxury. We are moving into existing space, or we've been in an existing space. Use the term repurposing space. If somebody's looking and saying, you know, I need to do something different, how big of a change does that have to be? Can you come in with and change out 10 or 20% of the items and help the company get that look and feel that they're after, or do they have to start from scratch?
Yeah, great question. Couple of answers. With some clients, our older existing clients, we are switching out small areas, testing certain collaborative spaces, seeing what types of rooms and open areas people will actually use before they make a bigger leap. But one thing I might add is that we see a lot of spaces, we're going to an existing space, we'll see the client, they're growing, right? They need to take on more space. And I start looking at their existing, frankly, older furniture and older planning paradigm. What we realize is, wow, with the right space design, the right contraction of space, condensing of certain spaces, we might be able to keep their operating costs fairly static or fairly similar and actually repurpose the space completely, including all new furniture. So in other words, instead of they don't need more space, they need better utilization of the space that they have.
Now, have you found one of the great selling points of technology was the ability to not even come into the office and to telecommute, work from home, work from the field. Does that really happen, or do you need workspace for every employee at almost all the businesses you see?
Well, we certainly work. At the end of the day, work is social, right? The connection with people is still critical to work. So what's interesting is the more there are alternatives to the more typical workspace, the more the workspace has to attract those people, right? There's a reason for them to come back. But I would sum it up. You mentioned Apple. There's a reason why Apple and Google and Oracle, and I could go on, and are building huge new campuses, making massive investments in new campuses, eBay, others, right? They wouldn't be doing that if they didn't, A, think space is critical, but B, also think they need to have a reason to attract any of those employees back to the corporate headquarters.
It's these, I've heard the term unintended collisions between your employees. Like I heard on the Apple campus, they very strategically located where the food is being served and frankly, where the restrooms are, to force different departments to have to intermingle. And, you know, it's great that they get to do that, and it shows the power. You were asking, can you work from home? The power of getting your workforce together. So I think there's a lot of business reasons to really think about how your workspace is designed. The reality, most small businesses, Park City's a small business, medium business type place, are on a tight budget. I know I've talked to other folks that have engaged your company for help in the past and similar companies. And typically, the business model is you guys will come in and share your thoughts, and it's not very expensive for that. Is that how your model works? And if people are interested in doing that, how would they reach out and ask for your help?
Well, first of all, we're happy to talk to any kind of a customer and provide a little education, a little bit of review of their space at no charge. I mean, that's what we're here for, right? We do want to educate and try to improve those spaces. The other thing is we do have a product line that has a variety of price points. Design does not have to be expensive. As a matter of fact, good design shouldn't be expensive, right? And then a customer can choose the quality of product, and they can choose when to get that product. We can do a phase arrangement, you know what I mean, where you start with certain areas and you build on that. Occasionally, we'll have access to some pretty decent used furniture. There's different ways to handle that budget issue, but we're happy to talk with any client, impart our knowledge on them, take a look at their space, and make some recommendations. And there's no charge for
you know
that.
And I would think the mindset in a lot of offices is the new guy gets the crappy desk and the broken chair, and that's you know, I read on your website that's the wrong approach. You want the new guy to feel the most welcome of all, because they're the new guy and they're uncomfortable.
That's funny, Larry. I had like the oldest chair at Albion when I joined, and I still have it to this day. So I'm a customer for a new chair for sure.
Well, you know, we talk about, again, I'm going to go back to what's more important than your people and hiring and attracting the best. You know, we did Adobe's headquarters in Lehigh. Beautiful space, right off the freeway. And the one thing's been intriguing is to have other customers say directly to us or say within their organization, especially in the ranks of the HR folks, wow, what happens if somebody goes and interviews at Adobe? What are we going to do? I mean, it's a big impact. So then I would say that space really has a huge impact on the bottom line of any organization. So.
Great. And tell us about your space. If I recall, it's an old religious, is it a Jewish tabernacle or a Catholic church? I forget.
So we house our corporate offices, headquarters, in the original Jewish synagogue in Salt Lake City. So it's 125 years old, stained glass is original, absolutely incredible space. And I always tell customers, hey, if I can figure out how to repurpose, reutilize, and build a brand in a Jewish synagogue, we can do your space.
But, and that's one thing you like to do, because you have offices elsewhere now, Boise and where
correct.
Else?
Yeah, we opened up in Las Vegas about 11 years ago. We've got St. George. We just recently opened up in Reno and Boise. And in all those locations, we have a real belief in finding buildings that are kind of a unique part of the architectural fabric of a community. So we've always found unique old buildings we can repurpose. So in Vegas, we have a 55-year-old bread manufacturing plant with these great ceilings and really neat. In Boise and Reno, Boise, we've got the original American Legion building built in 1939. In Reno, we've got this beautiful brick construction, 1936, open beam ceilings. We've got some really unique spaces.
Okay, well, I have to ask one last question before we go, because we're an NPR station, and for years, NPR's news has been brought to you by Herman Miller, and the announcer always says, home of the new Aeron chair, now available in true black. And I've been hearing that as a tag on every NPR
True
newscast.
Black. What is true
it's
black?
Like, it's like, so A, What's the big deal with an Aeron chair? And what's the big deal about true black? Is black is black?
Well, I'd make a couple of comments on it. First of all, Aeron was a chair that was brought out in 1994 by Herman Miller. So when you say new, it is the best-selling task chair in the history of work chairs. I know that sounds interesting. But it's also in the Museum of Modern Art. It really set a new reference point around ergonomic seating. Matter of fact, it's undergoing a redo as we speak, but it's still a fantastic chair.
So I guess the true black is the heart of it. And why did Herman Miller feel a need to drive that
point home?
They probably
spent hundreds of thousands of dollars picking the perfect black.
The nice thing about Aeron is most of them we sell are just black on black. Very classic Aeron chair. So anyway, but yeah, Aeron's a classic product from Herman Miller. Herman Miller has always been known as a leader in seating. And again, a real important component when you've got employees that are in a chair for a good majority of the day.
It is a long period of time. Larry, I know you asked the last question. I have one last question.
Sure.
You just rattled off a list of cities that you're in. What was the city that surprised you the most of how strong the start was, and what was the city that surprised you as how much work it was to get it going?
Well, I would say Las Vegas. We had a fantastic start, and then the recession hit.
Slowed down.
Yeah, the Great Recession, and let me tell you, in Las Vegas, it was a depression. I mean, we went from a dramatic ramp up in sales to a dramatic decrease, and now we're back up. But I guess Vegas has been the most interesting because it's been an absolute roller coaster ride. But I would encourage listeners to go onto our website. We have all of our locations on there. You can see our showrooms. Great photography, those individual spaces. Hopefully, they're inspiring people.
Go ahead and share that website and also a phone number to get.
Yeah, it's www.h is in Hendrickson, B is in Butler, D is in Design, G is in group.com. Phone number is 801-363-5881, and you can just ask for Andrea. She's our VP of Marketing. She can kind of put you in the right direction.
Okay. Well, David, we thank you for joining us. Our guest this morning has been David Colling. He is the CEO of Hendrickson Butler. And talking to us about how we can all make our workplaces a more fun, productive place to be.
Indeed.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining
us, David.
Now we're going to come back and talk chocolate.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
For more than 40 years, world-renowned physical theater troupe Mum and Schantz has dazzled, delighted, and mystified audiences. The Swiss-based troupe brings its zany fun to the Eccles Center April 4. It's a reality-suspending show for all ages, imaginative, surreal, joyful, and poignant. They take the stage at 7:30. For tickets, call 655-3114. Brought to you by the not-for-profit Park City Institute, educating, entertaining, and illuminating since 1998, and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We're going from sports to furniture, and now we're going to talk about maybe one of Park City's most favorite topics, chocolate. We all like treats. In studio with us now is Anna Davis and Robbie Stout. I'm sorry, Robbie. And they are partners at Ritual Chocolate, which is an artisan chocolate shop over by Iron Horse. Welcome to Mountain Money. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
So tell us what the concept of artisan chocolate is.
Well, we're what you call like a bean-to-bar chocolate factory. So that means we bring in cocoa beans from different farms around the world, and we source it specifically for the flavor. And so really unique flavors. You know, it can be fruity, it can be nutty, it can be earthy, everything. It's just like
almost
wine.
Almost like wine taste. Yeah, exactly.
Wine
taste.
Yeah. And so, you know, what we do is we take those beans and take it through this long process of roasting, winnowing, grinding, milling, refining, conching, tempering, wrapping, and, you know, all that. And so it's just like this very handcrafted kind of method of producing just chocolate. We don't even make truffles. It's literally just chocolate. So,
yeah. You know, I would have had a hard time visualizing all of that, except I was at Dandelion's Chocolate in San Francisco.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
And I'm wondering, have you been there, and is your concept similar where it's kind of like Dandelion's is kind of like a wine tasting as well as where you can buy chocolate? Are you offering both and also educating consumers on how chocolate is made or good chocolate is made?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. The space on Iron Horse, we're really trying to open it up so people can come in and see the whole chocolate making process. And even though every bean to bar maker, their process is a little bit different, it's a very similar concept to Dandelion, so you can go in and, you know, try the chocolate. And
let me contrast this, because I think most people's vision of a chocolate factory is what our friend Willy Wonka has taught us all. So I'm guessing there's no Oompa Loompas on an Iron Horse. But it is.
Maybe a couple.
I kid you not. I mean, my kids were like, this is how they make chocolate.
Yeah.
So it is open, and they can see how you guys go from you mentioned earlier, bean to bar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And actually, most people that work there are like over 6'5". It's really weird. I'm 6'5", and I'm like the shortest guy there. I don't know how that happened.
Well, looking at your website, and go to the website, ritualchocolate.com. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Okay. Yep.
Going there, you've got some neat videos of chocolate mm-hmm. making, and, mm-hmm. and it looked like the equipment was ancient. It looked like from the dawn of the industrial age, this
exactly.
equipment you have.
Yeah, some of it, we're still waiting on a piece right now. That one is from around 1910. It was made in Switzerland, and it was used for about 80 years by this company called Suchard in Switzerland. And then somehow it found its way to a barn in Hamburg, and it was stored there for a long time. And then finally it got to the U.S. still stuffed with the hay that was in the barn. I don't know how that passed customs, because that usually doesn't fly. But right now, that's being refurbished, and we'll have it in hopefully about a month. Mm-hmm. But
so this is obviously a passion, mm-hmm. and I mentioned Dandelions. You know, this is a guy that sold his company for hundreds of millions of dollars, took a year off, went to Europe, found out back in the day, 200 years ago, his family were chocolatiers, mm-hmm. And he wanted to reconnect with that. So that was his path to getting into this. Mm. Why is chocolate such a big part of your lives, and why did you want to dedicate your business to this?
Well, I think we both have our own sort of background there. You know, my family.
Go ahead and tell both stories.
Yeah, I'll tell my story, and then Anna will tell hers. So my background, my family started doing chocolate and candy in Utah back in around 1920, and they had a shop in Salt Lake from around 1920 to the mid 60s called Hall's Confectionery. And so it's kind of part of the blood. You know, they continued it a little bit in California, and then in Heber, and it's not something that I never really thought much about candy. And what we do now is definitely not candy. I would never say we make candy. We make fine chocolate. And so it's just kind of been in the blood, and it just seemed like a nice thing to do, you know, when we had the idea. And so Anna's story kind of connects it all.
Yeah, so I think, so my family in England are actually farmers, a generation of farmers. I'm from Essex in England. And so for us, it was sort of Robbie having that background of candy manufacturing. And then, you know, I come from this agricultural background. So really, bean to bar chocolate making and sourcing directly from the farmers kind of marries those two things together. Mm-hmm. So we just found it really fascinating. And there's so many elements to chocolate making and the bean sourcing and chocolate tasting that just really, really interested us. So
the beans come from where? The tropical countries and many different countries.
Pods, really.
On different
pods.
On different continents.
Yeah, they're like these football-sized pods that grow on trees. And they grow. The reason they grow so many different places is that they grow within 20 degrees north and south of the equator. So around the world. So you can find it in Madagascar. I actually brought a bar today. Madagascar, Ecuador, Peru, Mexico, but you won't find it much further north than that. They need really specific conditions, warm, humid. Yeah.
And let's talk about these footballs, because I thought, Larry, like you, chocolate beans, small beans, like a jelly bean is what I was expecting.
Like a coffee bean.
Exactly, yeah. But it's very different. So you guys mm-hmm. get the pods in, right?
Well.
Or no, you're chucked or shucked already? I forget what the term is.
Yeah, so we actually get the beans, which is actually the seeds of the fruit, so it's kind mm-hmm. of confusing that they're called cacao beans. And they've already been fermented and dried by the farmer. So, there's sort of these sort of whole bean in the shell. And so we get them in big burlap sacks, and then we kind of do a whole bean roast.
And Larry was mentioning, you know, thinking of a coffee bean, there's this whole sustainable market pricing for coffee beans. Is it similar in chocolate? Are those farmers getting squeezed on price? And is there a sustainable market initiative in chocolate as well?
I think the commodity exchange cacao or cocoa is definitely they get squeezed pretty hard there. It's not a very nice model for them. It's not sustainable. You actually see a lot of farmers leaving the market because of that. Our market, we call it kind of like the flavor model. We'll pay whatever we have to for the best flavor possible. So, you know, some of our farms are charging $5 a pound. That's five times the world price for cacao. So our bars are more expensive. And the whole reason for that is our ingredients are a lot more expensive. And we're willing to pay it because, you know, they've put in a lot of effort to create a flavor that you can't find on the commodities market. And, you know, and our customers can taste the difference. You know, it's just... everyone kind of wins in this model.
And it kind of sounds like a like wine. There are vintages. The cocoa bean from 1 year is going to taste different than one from the next year. And
yeah, absolutely. I mean, we put harvest year right on our bar with the batch number, because all these different things, you know, kind of add to the flavor and the subtle nuances of each bar. So we just really, I think with the harvest year, you know, we want people to start thinking about chocolate like wine and like fine coffee. So,
and is there like wine, you know, wine for a while will get better with time. Is it the same with chocolate? I mean, does it keep on the shelf well? And is it better if you can to let it age for 5 years?
that's a tricky question. The answer could be yes to that if we didn't have to worry about the fat structure changing in the bar. So like when we temper chocolate, we make sure the fat settles in a way that it snaps, you know, in your, like you can make it snap, it melts in your mouth, it's shiny. Those crystals, that's like the beta 5 crystal, that can transition over time to like the number 6, which won't melt in your mouth. It's kind of white and chalky. At that point, there's actually nothing wrong with the chocolate. It's just the fat needs to be remelted and retempered. And if you take chocolate and let it sit around for a while, the tannins in there will begin to mellow, and it can improve the chocolate. And sometimes it can make it taste, I mean, it can lose flavor as well. But if you could take that chocolate, remelt it, and temper it, then yeah, you might have something really interesting. So
the other interesting thing is there are videos of you hand wrapping each chocolate bar. That just seems really hands-on and tedious, but it is a limited run you're doing. So these are not, certainly not, I won't insult you by comparing them to Hershey's, because they're nothing like a Hershey bar. Mm-hmm. They're thicker and they're more expensive, and of course they taste much better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we, you know, we wrapped about 100,000 bars last year, so.
That's a lot. Like this dandelion in San Francisco, they make 500 bars a day, so I'm curious, how many bars are you guys doing?
Right now we're doing about 600 bars a day.
So you're as big as dandelion. Yeah. And is most of the business, Park City is a small town, is your thought most of the business going to be shipping the bars elsewhere or sold here locally?
Yeah, most of our business is wholesale to different accounts around the country. Mm-hmm. So,
but if they want a taste of them in Park City, where do they go?
There's a few different places. The Whole Foods, the market, and of course our shop. So
your shop, people can come in, spend some time there. Are there seats there where people can sit down?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got seating, and we can make a hot chocolate out of any of those origins, or you can taste any of the chocolate. And we're right at 1105 Iron Horse, and we're open every day of the week. So,
including Sunday?
Yep.
I wanted to stop by before you guys came in. Well, thank you guys for joining us. Our guests have been Anna Davies and Robbie Stout. They are the founders of Ritual Chocolate on 1105 Iron Horse. Sounds like an exciting venture. You will see me in the next couple of weeks. I love going to places like that. Thank you for coming.
Right, thank you. Thanks for coming in. We'll wrap things up in just a moment.
Hello, this is David Brancaccio. Join me for the Marketplace Morning Report at 6:51 and 7:51 a.m. here on KPCW, bringing you the morning business news for the rest of us in the time that takes you to savor your first cup of joe. Marketplace Morning Report is, I think, a useful way to start your day. That's the Marketplace Morning Report, weekday mornings here on 91.9 and 88.1 FM KPCW.
Brought to you in part by Park City Mountain Resort, Cushman Wakefield Commerce Commercial Real Estate, and Canyons Resort.
Hey, welcome back. I want to thank our sponsors who bring Mountain Money to you every week. They include Mountain West Bank, the Park City Chamber, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, and Jones Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
I really enjoyed that show today. We had a little bit of everything, and all three of those topics were really interesting.
Well, artisan chocolate is a big thing these days, and
it is a big thing. And the theme is, you know, eat less but eat high quality and the best stuff that you can. I love that concept.
Indeed, and office furniture. It's interesting the way, and it really is. That first impression is last. So if you walk into an office and it pops, it really tells. So thanks very much for joining us, Doug Wells and Larry Warren. This has been Mountain Money, and it's KPCW Park City.